Every once in a while, you just rip something off in the pursuit of art. And so I begin this segment with a line ripped off from CBS News correspondent Morley Safer, a piece he did on 60 Minutes more than 10 years ago. It began like this. Who is the artist who has sold more canvases than any other painter in history? More than Picasso, Rembrandt, Gauguin, Monet, Manet, Renoir, and Van Gogh combined. If you didn't say Thomas Kincaid, then you've been shopping in the wrong places. He's the most collected living artist in the U.S. and worldwide. He produces paintings by the container load, and he is to art what Henry Ford was to automobiles. Well, what Morley Safer said back in 2001 is still true today, and Thomas Kincaid, the self-appointed painter of light, died last Friday. Supremely successful, loathed by the smug art world, collected by people looking for something uplifting and positive in art, by many estimates, 1 in 20 American homes have at least one of Kincaid's works hanging on the walls. Susan Orlean penned one of the most comprehensive profiles ever written on Thomas Kincaid for The New Yorker back in 2001, entitled Art for Everybody. She's also the author of The Orchid Thief, Rin Tin Tin, many other books. She joins us from California. Susan, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much.
Thomas Kincaid was certainly an American original in his story of success and in defying the establishment. Was he an artistic original in your sense?
That's a question he would have loved to have debated with you. Creating art that would be consumed in large quantities, essentially being a populist painter, is not a new idea. I think he would certainly be categorized as the person who made it the most commercially potent idea that we've come across. The images are not unusual. They're not original in that sense. They're images of a kind of fantastic, perfect, serene landscape, a kind of fantasy of a pastoral landscape. And I think people have been painting pictures like that for eternity.
And the Thomas Kincaid brand, of course, is these cozy, warm buildings off in the snow, or landscapes that are tranquil, sunsets, this sort of thing. Describe the production machine that actually produced these things, and particularly the levels of price point that you could buy. There were originals that were almost impossible to find, but then there were highlighted prints and an actual industrial workforce of highlighters who made a lot of money selling these quasi prints.
This is where Kincaid was sort of a genius. He realized that he could sell a painting once, and that was it. The transaction would be very limited. On the other hand, if he created an image and then produced it in all of these varieties and different levels of exclusivity, he could kind of infinitely produce income from one single image. So there were he didn't sell as originals. He produced the more of a hands-on experience that you got in your picture from him, the more it was worth. So if he produced a print that he himself highlighted, those were going to be the most valuable. So the print was something basically manufactured. And then he, or more often somebody who is trained to do this, would daub individual bits of paint and highlight the picture, making it exclusive and a sort of one-off version of that picture. But then he would also produce posters, keychains. You know, you could have a Kincaid for $2, $5, $500, $5,000, depending on how exclusive an item you wanted. And he produced a perfect pyramid of painting, so to speak.
And worth tens of millions of dollars, went public at one point, traded his company on the NASDAQ and the New York Stock Exchange. So I wonder if you would describe the Master Highlighter event that you attended, because as you describe it, it seems like a cross between Florence during the Renaissance and an infomercial.
Yeah, it was a pretty incredible experience. The other thing that Kincaid did, which was both brilliant and ultimately problematic, is he set up a chain of galleries that sold his work exclusively. One of the things that these galleries did was to hold these events where you could come in, pick the picture you wanted. These were, in many cases, a sort of digital reproduction of the picture. And then you had a 10-minute session with a master highlighter who was trained not only in how to highlight the picture, but also as a sort of medium through which Thomas Kincaid would speak. They were trained to learn everything about him, his children's names, his birthday, his personal life story. So they would talk to you about that, but then also daub the paint. If you said, you know, I really like pink, they would put a little bit of extra pink on the rose bush in your painting. If you wanted more highlighting in the sky, they would do highlighting in the sky. And every now and again, if you ask, they would let you do some highlighting in your own picture. So it was kind of fascinating. And people were filled with a kind of rapture as they were buying their picture that was just unbelievable, something I've never seen before.
Well, here's a tough question then. I mean, how is that different from, say, Caravaggio being instructed by his patron to maybe put a little more brown over there in that face? Or why is it pears all the time? Couldn't it be some more strawberries in your still lives? I mean, there was plenty of direction given to the patroned artists in the Italian Renaissance. And in an era of Photoshop, do we have a problem maybe with the manipulations of Kincaid that, in fact, people do every single day with images?
Well, he made this point, and I found talking to him absolutely fascinating. I mean, he was very aware that people said, this is kitsch, these pictures are, you know, silly, shallow images, and the way they're marketed is just... it's commercial and has no artistic value. He argued absolutely what you're saying. Number one, this has been traditional in art from the beginning of time. Secondly, if people enjoy it, why is that wrong? What makes that less valuable than a Damien Hirst shark carcass in formaldehyde that's repulsive? You know, why should art be unlikable rather than likable? Why should it be something you can't touch as opposed to something where you say, I do like pink, so put a little more pink in my picture? It's kind of hard to not at least see the point of what he's saying, whether you agree with it or not. And I came away from my meeting with him a little bit shocked by how many good points he made about what he was doing as opposed to what critics said.
Susan Orlean, when you learned of his death, a sense of sadness. There was one point in your article where you describe how the galleries, you know, get a lot of cancer survivors to come in and just look at these images and feel better. What are your thoughts?
Well, certainly at age 54, his death is a big surprise. And the last few years have been troubled for him. A lot of problems, a lot of financial issues that came up. But he made one point that was hard to argue against, which is, why should art only make people feel bad? Why can't it make people feel good? He was a very interesting, very complicated provocateur, which would never seem to be the case when you look at those images that are so soothing and optimistic. But in fact, he was skewering a lot of what people who think we know a lot about art, he sort of threw a lot of big questions up in the air. And I thought those were kind of interesting.
Susan Orlean, with a comprehensive profile, one of the most comprehensive ever written on Thomas Kincaid for The New Yorker 2001, entitled Art for Everybody. She's also the author of The Orchid Thief, Rin Tin Tin, and several other books. She joined us from California to discuss the passing of Thomas Kincaid, who died last week at the age of 54. Susan, thanks so much.
My pleasure, John.
We're wondering what art moves you. What do you consider great art and why? You can let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post your comment at thetakeaway.org. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.